Welcome back. Hope you all had a nice lunch and saw some really exciting posters out there. We'll start the afternoon session with Morag Park. Professor Park did her degrees in Scotland, Glasgow, and she still has a bit of an accent, but not too much. Has been in Canada for a long time, was at the Royal Victoria Hospital, has been the director of the CIHR Center Institute in Cancer, and has taken over last year the Goodman Center. She's been one of the leading lights internationally in the field of breast cancer research, and we're all looking forward to hear what she has to tell us. Morag.
To my exercise class the other night, so all the old joints are hurting. So thanks very much for the invitation. And I put in this title, and then when I looked at some of the posters that were circulated in advance, I actually changed the talk a little bit to highlight some concepts that may be of interest to this group. I did title it Breast Cancer in the Post-Genomic Age, and I would probably like to add maybe back to the basics, because I think these are the critical questions that we need to think about. So just in case you don't really quite know, so breast cancer mostly arises from the epithelial cells in the ducts or lobules of the breast. And I'm sure all of you know this, that there's two layers of epithelial cells in these ducts or lobules. One are the luminal epithelial cells that line the duct, and these are surrounded by what are called myoepithelial cells. In the initial stages of breast cancer, is just an aberrant proliferation of cells within the ducts, and these are called DCIS, or ductal carcinoma in situ. And at that stage, the cancer is pre-neoplastic, and it hasn't really burst the basement membrane. So the transition to neoplastic breast cancer is this transition from through the basement membrane, where these cells now grow and develop into a cancer. What's an important concept, and historically this is how breast cancer has been considered in the clinic, that not all breast cancers are the same. So for more than 20 years, we've understood that there are at least two major types of breast cancer. One subtype is positive for the estrogen receptor, and that's about 60 to 70% of women. And these women don't tell me. It's on some automatic. That's never happened. Does anybody know how to un-automatic it?
I don't think it's automatic.
Yeah, it just did it on its own. Well, we'll see. It's all right, I'll keep going back. Let's hope that doesn't go through the whole presentation. So one of the subtypes, which is about 60 to 70% of women, are positive for the estrogen receptor. And this can be identified by histology, by immunohistochemistry in the clinic for estrogen receptor positivity. And then these women can be treated with tamoxifen, for example, which is an anti-estrogen agent. What's important maybe to point out for you is that not 100% of the tumor cells are positive for the estrogen receptor. And even within this subtype, you'll get variable levels of positivity ranging from 10% to maybe 100% of the cells. So, of course, this is a challenge for pathologists to make the call on estrogen receptor positivity. Another subtype that's evolved in the last 20 years, which reflects about 20% of women, are those tumors that are positive for the HER2 receptor. And this positivity is due to the fact that the HER2 receptor is amplified in these cancers. And again, this provides a target for an immunotherapy, essentially, to the HER2 receptor that's called Herceptin, and this is available in the healthcare system in Canada and in Quebec. What is interesting is a new, an isolated subtype of breast cancer that was actually called triple negative at the level of pathology, and these are negative for the estrogen receptor, negative for the HER2 receptor, and also negative for the progesterone receptor. And at the moment, there are no known therapeutic targets to target this subtype of breast cancer, and this reflects about 15% of the population. So it's clear that these three subgroups of women cannot be treated in the same way. What's evolved in the last 10 years is a new approach to think about breast cancer and other cancers. And this has been based on the use of gene expression profiling. So instead of looking at cancers based on their immunohistochemistry profile, what's evolved is the ability to harvest these tumor cells and look at gene expression and compare these types of tumors to one another, but also compare these to the HER2-positive tumors and to the triple-negative tumors. By gene expression profiling, you essentially capture a snapshot of the genes that are expressed in that tumor at the time it was removed from the patient. And here, what we're comparing are different patients on this axis compared to genes that are differentially expressed. The red indication is high levels of expression, whereas green reflects lower levels of expression. And this, of course, is in comparison to the other breast cancers that are being analyzed here. So I think what you can see quite clearly is that there are distinct groups of women whose tumors are different. So what you can say is that women in this subgroup look quite similar. They have high levels of expression of these genes, low levels of these, high levels of expression of these. And by comparing these patterns, you can generate what are called clusters or distinct subgroups of tumors. And what's evolved are five distinct subgroups of tumors that can be identified by gene expression profiling. Two of these subgroups are called luminal A and luminal B. And both of these subgroups are women whose tumors are estrogen receptor positive. I think what you can see is that there are subtle differences between these, and what we do know now is that the luminal B subgroup tends to have a worse outcome. They don't respond as well to therapy compared to the luminal A subgroup. In addition, we can identify this HER2-enriched subgroup. Again, what you'll see is they're quite different from the luminal subgroup, and they have distinct sets of gene expression. The most interesting subgroup that evolved from these types of studies are the triple negative subgroup that is now identified into two subclasses. One is called the basal-like subgroup, and the other is called the Claudin-low subgroup. And I noticed that many of you have posters looking at Claudins, so that might be an interesting subgroup for you to think about. What this also gave is the ability to begin to ask questions on what is the origin of these breast cancers? Historically, it was considered that the basal subgroup was evolved from differentiated myoepithelial cells. And this was based on the fact that they had what's called basal cytokeratin, so cytokeratin 14, for example. And differentiated myoepithelial cells also had cytokeratin 14. But if you compare gene expression profiling of breast cancers with normal mammary epithelial cells that are isolated from mammary glands, and this is work of Jane Visveder about 5 years ago, what she proposed was that most breast cancers appear to show most similarities to either bipotential progenitor cells within the normal stem cell lineage or cells that evolve down the luminal lineage. So, for example, the differentiated luminal cells found in normal mammary glands showed most similarity by gene expression to the luminal A and the luminal B subgroup. These are the ones that are estrogen receptor positive. These are also cytokeratin 8, 18 positive, both the differentiated cells and these tumors. What was interesting and was quite a surprise, actually, was that the HER2-amplified tumors, which are very aggressive tumors, had hallmarks of late luminal progenitors. And so these tumors, although they're not fully differentiated, they have many hallmarks of differentiated luminal progenitor cells, and they're also cytokeratin 8 and 18 positive. What was interesting is that the basal subgroup, rather than reflecting a myoepithelial progenitor or differentiated myoepithelial cells, these tumors most closely reflected either the luminal progenitors or these bipotential progenitor cells. The bipotential progenitor cells are usually positive for cytokeratin 5 and 6, as well as cytokeratin 8 and 14. And when you look at these basal tumors, what you find is that they often have pluripotency for positivity for cytokeratins. This subgroup called claudin low tends to be predominantly cytokeratin 5-6 positive and has been associated with the more stem-like cells of the mammary gland. But I think what we have to be careful there is that the claudin low subtype of breast cancer are lacking junctional claudins, and these cells tend to be very mesenchymal in phenotype. And what we know is that stem cells are also mesenchymal, so at that level, this may more reflect a mesenchymal type gene expression pattern rather than a stem cell pattern. But these types of studies have actually given us tools to begin to think about how breast cancer evolves and to ask the questions, does this reflect plasticity from differentiated luminal cells, or does it reflect actually differentiation down the luminal lineage? By what gene expression profiling has also provided are the potential to use this type of information in the clinic. And these types of what we now call molecular profiles are being at least developed to try and make predictions for disease progression. Can you predict outcome, and can you predict outcome to different treatments, for example? But also, for example, could you predict drug sensitivity or therapeutic responses? What's already evolved in the clinic are a number of tests that are based on gene expression profiling. One of them is called Oncotype DX, and this is a subset of 19 genes that are used to predict within the luminal subtype, the luminal A and the luminal B patients, those patients with the worst outcome. And in this case, this signature is actually being used to decide not to treat those individuals that are predicted to have a good outcome. So you actually protect them from chemotherapy or radiotherapy. Another type of test is called MammaPrint, and this is a 70-gene signature that's being used to predict those patients that would progress to metastatic disease. So this was developed by comparing non-metastatic breast cancers to metastatic breast cancers. And both of these are in large clinical trials at the moment for decision-making in breast cancer. Oncotype DX is already approved by the government of Ontario and can be supported by the healthcare system in Ontario. So now I'm going to sort of switch gears a little bit. When we started to get interested in breast cancer, and this was over maybe 12 years ago, what our interest was not just in the tumor itself, because what we knew at that time was that tumors evolve essentially as an ecosystem. You have both the proliferation and expansion of the tumor cells, but this must occur within a tumor microenvironment that can support this tumor cell expansion. And this includes the ability to develop a new blood supply. What we can see is there's matrix remodeling, and these tumors must also show some level of evasion of the immune system. So with that in mind, we decided to take a different approach, and rather than just look at gene expression profiling in whole tumors, we wanted to ask, are there differences within this stromal microenvironment with different breast cancer subtypes? And so what we had established in the late 1990s was a breast tumor bank at the MUHC. And this was focused to harvest breast tumors, but in a very strict quality control fashion, whereby we collect tumors in the surgery, take them to pathology, and they're frozen within about 20 minutes post-surgery. These tumors are then high quality control and can be used for types of studies that would allow us to manipulate them and look at gene expression. And we chose to use what's called laser capture microdissection that allows us to isolate cells that are either the normal mammary epithelial cells or the tumor mammary epithelial cells from the same section, from the same patient. So for example, if we harvest the normal mammary epithelial cells, we'll make RNA from these cells that are captured on the cap. Or if we harvest the stroma that surrounds normal mammary epithelial cells, we'll make RNA from these cells. And again, we can look in the tumor bed and we can harvest the epithelial, the tumor cells in the tumor bed, and also the stroma that is surrounding the tumor cells. And of course, the stroma, but we know, is a mixed number of different cell types that is recruited into the stroma. We can then process these by gene expression profiling. And that now gives us a sort of picture of all the compartments from that single person, from both the tumor cells and the normal mammary epithelial cells. And when we do the type of clustering that others have done by using whole gene expression from whole tumors, what we saw was something that looked quite distinct. So if we compare only the epithelial cells, what you see is there's not a big difference. There is a difference in gene expression within these, but it's not dramatic. These are the HER2 amplified tumors, and this is the locus. This is the HER2 amplicon that we can easily see. These are your triple negative tumors. These are the basal-like tumors. And you see that these are very different at the level of the tumor epithelial cells to the luminal A and the luminal B subtypes. What was quite surprising to us was the variation that we see within the stroma that we've isolated from the same tumors. And perhaps more surprisingly was the fact that if you look at these gene expression profiles, you can identify patients that look very similar to one another. Now, within the tumor epithelia, what we know is that these are changes in gene expression within the tumor cells. But within the stroma, this could reflect both a change in gene expression, but also the ability to recruit different cells within the stromal microenvironment. So that allowed us to ask very simple questions on how complex is the breast stroma. And so here we can now begin to drill in, just as people have done by looking at gene expression on whole tumors, as to what are the genes that distinguish these different stromal subtypes. So for example, with this group, we look at only these genes. With this group, we look at only those genes. And with this group, we look at both genes that are up and genes that are down. So if we just scan across these are the different squares that I just showed you in the previous slide. What you'll see quite clearly is within these genes, this gene set, and that's this group here, these genes are highly expressed in these individuals, but I think it's quite clear that they're not expressed in the other patient's stroma. Similarly, we can see high levels of expression of these genes, but these are not expressed in the other patient's stroma. So this tells us that the stroma that's associated with these individuals' breast cancer tumors is quite different, yet they're quite similar to one another within this subset. So we can begin now to ask questions as to what does that mean from a biology perspective. What's the difference in these stromal microenvironments? And we can first of all do this by just looking at the types of genes that are identified and that will identify that subcluster of patients. So for example, one set of genes are associated with matrix remodeling. These are collagenases, matrilysins, a lot of collagen deposition, and this is associated often with what pathologists will describe as fibrotic stroma. And this is a hallmark in pathology that we can now begin to associate with gene expression. We have other subsets that are associated with an immune response, and in this case, it's what we would call a positive immune response. So we've got activated NK cells, presence of T helper cells, for example. We have other subsets that are associated with activated fibroblast signatures. So these reflect what has been known before as, for example, what are called cancer-associated fibroblasts. So we can see that some patients are enriched their stroma for these cell types. What perhaps was more important is if we take each of these distinct stromal subsets of genes and compare them to outcome. So we now go back into large clinical data sets, 1,000 patients, that have been generated by looking at gene expression from the whole tumor. We use our stromally derived genes and we look at outcome. So what we see is that the matrix remodeling, the fibroblast signature and this hypoxic signature are associated with poor outcome, whereas the immune response and a signature we call ER signaling is associated with good outcome. If we use the molecular breast cancer subtypes, so those genes that identify the luminal subtype, the HER2 subtype, and the triple negative subtype, in the same patient's data, you will see good outcome and you'll see poor outcome. But I think what you can see quite clearly is that the stromal data actually gives you a much more pronounced split between good and poor outcome in these same patients. So clearly, the changes within the stroma are associated with outcome, and we now know they can evolve in a distinct way from the classical molecular or pathological subtypes that are classified in pathology. So this lets us begin to ask questions. How does this stroma evolve? How do you get different stroma that is recruited to different breast cancers? So we can, again, use different informatics approaches to ask very simple questions. And we can ask questions such as, if you have immune stroma, stroma that's enriched for the presence of NK cells, T cells, for example, that's the immune signature that orders these patients. What we see is if we order all of the patients on this side that are devoid of that immune signature, so that means they're not enriched for immune cells, are the patients whose stroma is called hypoxic or has essentially a stress response. So this then tells us that if your stroma looks like this by gene expression, it's unlikely that you're able to support or sustain the proliferation or survival of a T-cell component or activation of NK cells. And we've actually, I didn't put these slides in, but we've validated this by immunohistochemistry. We can take other approaches, for example. If we look at this hypoxic signature, what we find is that this is always associated with both a very hypoxic response in the tumor cells as well as in the stroma cells. Now, we know that all tumors to progress must undergo a hypoxic switch, where they begin to express genes such as VEGF that will promote a new angiogenic response. But these tumors are evolving in a sustained hypoxic stress response. So clearly, the stroma, the normal cells in this microenvironment, are under quite different conditions compared to those stromal cells that would be present in other breast cancers. And we can drill in to look at, for example, the fibroactivated fibroblasts, and we can show that they also evolve distinctly from the tumor cell type. So now the types of questions that we're interested in asking is, how does the tumor promote the evolution of distinct stroma? Or is it that the stroma actually supports the evolution of the tumor? And we can begin to ask these questions now. We can ask clinically associated questions that, are the stromal subtypes associated with outcome, and could we use these actually as tools to predict outcome within the molecular subtypes of breast cancer? Because we know if you look at the luminal A and luminal B subtypes and you treat these patients with tamoxifen, not everybody responds well. We know that in the HER2 subtype, all positive for the HER2 receptor, you treat these patients with Herceptin, they also have a different response. So we can begin to ask again these types of questions, looking at large data sets that are published in the literature and asking specifically association of this distinct stromal subtypes. For example, if you look only within the HER2 subtype, if you have this stroma that we call hypoxic, this is always associated with poor outcome, whereas an immune-enriched stroma in these patients is associated with a good outcome. If we look in the basal or triple negative subtype, if they have matrix remodeling stroma, that's associated with poor outcome. And again, every time we have the presence of this immune-enriched component, this is always associated with good outcome. So this gives us some tools that we can begin to use to generate prognostic signatures or decision-making tools. And we could translate, and that's what we're trying to do, some of these signatures into immunohistochemistry-based tests that could be applied in the clinic with the standard immunohistochemistry-based tests that distinguish the subtypes of breast cancer. So we can develop this by trying to develop a signature that could be used in the clinic in a similar way to the Oncotype DX, and we've done this to generate a signature of 26 genes. I won't go into the details, but just to show you again, if we compare the 26 genes that we develop in our stromal predictor with this MammoPrint predictor. So MammoPrint was generated on this cohort and identifies poor outcome and good outcome patients. we take our stromal predictor on the same cohort, what you see is that we can identify poor outcome patients more efficiently or more accurately than the MammaPrint predictor. So this tells us that changes in the stroma are evolving and are distinct and additive to the changes that are occurring in the tumor. So what I'd conclude with is to say that the stroma surrounding the tumor is heterogeneous, it has prognostic value, and the distinct combinations of tumors with molecular subtypes could be used for clinical decision-making in the future. But I think, and I'm sure what many of you are asking is, well, what does that mean? Does that actually mean anything to do with the biology of the tumor? So if we want to ask these questions, we've got no choice but to go back into an experimental system. And for this, we've chosen to look at mouse models of mammary tumors. But here, what we've been able to use is a homogeneous inbred strain, in this case, it's the FVB mouse, with different expression of different oncogenes that drive the formation of mammary tumors. And in each case, we've chosen oncogenes that are under the same promoter. In this case, it's the MMTV promoter. So this is the most homogeneous system that we can generate to compare different stroma in these different mammary tumors. Now, when we started this, everybody said, well, mouse tumors don't have any stroma. But that's because most people let their mouse tumors grow as big as they can before they sacrifice the mouse. So if you take these at about 0.5 centimeters, you'll see that every single mouse model that we've looked at so far has abundant stroma. So we can go in and we can look at the stroma and we can look at the epithelium, just exactly as we did with human breast cancer. And so what's interesting is what we see, if you have a different oncogene, you have different stroma. So these are identical mouse models. So this I can't see, but it doesn't really matter. I think that's the polyoma middle T mouse. This is the Wnt mouse. And these are the two receptor tyrosine kinases, which is the HER2 receptor in MET. So I think if you look at this stroma, it's quite different. So that could say that, well, have oncogene in your epithelium, the stroma that evolves with that tumor is different depending on the oncogene that's present within the epithelium. So this, we could correlate back to breast cancer and say, well, the genetic changes that occur in that tumor may be driving how the stroma evolves in that tumor. But this lets us ask other questions, because the key questions that we need to ask is the stroma important for the evolution of the tumor? Or is it just that the tumor recruits whatever goodies it wants into the tumor bed? So we asked this question in collaboration with a group in Ohio State. And what they had done was to use a fibroblast-specific promoter to drive the Cre recombinase. And they then knocked out different genes in fibroblasts. They started with P10. They also knocked out P53. This is not to say that these genes are lost in fibroblasts, but it's a simple question, just like making transgenic mice, to ask, what's the significance if I change the fibroblasts and look at tumor growth? So in this case, they knocked out P10. This is a tumor suppressor. It's also a regulator of the PI3 kinase pathway in fibroblasts. So these mice are alive, they're fine, and they're healthy. Now, this is gone. So then you challenge them. So you transplant an ERBB2 or a HER2 mammary tumor into the glands of these mice. So this is your wild-type mouse, and this is the tumor growth. If the same piece of tumor or the same size piece of tumor is transplanted into the P10 null fibroblast mice, what you see is that this tumor grows much more rapidly. And I don't have the next slide, but if you look at the pathology of these tumors, they're much more reflective of human HER2 breast cancer compared to these tumors that are in the wild-type mice. Now we can ask quite simple questions. We can say, okay, if you look at the fibroblasts where you lose P10 or not, before you've got the challenge of the tumor, and you compare this to human breast cancer, to our stromal data in human breast cancer, what you see is that those genes that are elevated in the P10 null fibroblasts before they even see a tumor correlate with those genes that we see elevated in the tumor stroma in human breast cancer. So this provides, I think, some of the best evidence to say that changes in the fibroblasts are critical to support the growth of a developing mammary epithelial tumor, even a tumor that is really well advanced. Now, what's more interesting, they've gone on to knock out the P53 gene by a similar type of strategy. And those P53 null fibroblast mice do not support the growth of these HER2 tumors, but do support the growth of other mammary tumors. So what that also says is that distinct events in the fibroblast could support the growth of different genetically changed epithelial cells. And clearly, this is something that's important for us to begin to go back and ask in human breast cancer to understand, could we interfere with this codependency between the fibroblasts and the epithelial tumor cells? And so these are the types of directions that we're now trying to do by setting up co-culture assays with fresh tumor epithelial cells from primary tumors, and also isolating the fibroblasts from the same patients, from the tumor bed, and asking, do they support the growth of one another, and can you interfere with this codependency when these two cell types are grown together? So obviously these are large collaborations, and I do absolutely nothing these days. We've been very lucky to have fantastic collaborations with many people at the MUHC, and this started when we were over in the Royal Victoria Group. Sarkis Matarissin, who was the head of surgery, but also with pathologists such as Attila Omerloglu. We've worked with Mike Hallett's group to look at informatics. We've got lots of collaborations with people working on similar types of approaches, and the mouse work I showed you was Mike Ostrowski and Gustavo Leone. These are the people that did all the work, and I can assure you that this was a huge amount of work, and Margarita Sulamnyova, who's a research associate in the lab, really did the majority of the laser capture microdissection, which do not give this to students as a sort of side project, because everything has bias. And the most important thing is that whatever bias you generate has to be reproducible. So we have one person that does the LCM, and Hong Zhao does all the amplifications of the RNA and all of the hybridizations. So just if you're interested in techniques and technologies, we can start with as little as 1 nanogram of RNA from microdissected material, amplify this reproducibly, and use this to look at gene expression. We can actually immunostain sections in advance. If you've got very good antibodies, frozen sections, we can immunostain in advance and go in and microdissect these specific cell types that we want to harvest that are positive for whatever immunostain you want. So these, we have all the protocols for these, and we'd be happy to help anybody who wants to look at these types of questions. So thanks very much.
Hey, Mara.
See, I seeded a question to
what?
You.
So, no, I finally understand fully what you are doing. And I have a question. And that those trauma phenotype, is there really stable phenotype or the more like a mature indication of the mature stage or the early stage?
So that's a really good question. We haven't, of course, you can't do this in human breast cancer where you could go in and look early and then look late. We've done this a little bit in the mouse models, and it's clear that as they're evolving, even at an early stage, the stroma is evolving in a distinct manner with the distinct mouse models. But I think that these are very important questions to ask. What I can say is that these tumors are of different, you know, some tumors are very large and high grade, and I didn't go into all the details, so they might be 6 or 7 centimeters, whereas others are only 1 centimeter. And we can clearly see the same stroma in large tumors or small tumors. And so this evolution to grade or size is not generating a distinct stroma. So our interpretation is that this is evolving together with the genomic alterations that have occurred in these tumors. But also it's likely that the host plays quite an important role in this. And so the host environment, your ability to elicit an immune response and a sustained immune response may be a critical factor as well.
So, original tumor and the metastasized stroma is the same type?
Well, we haven't looked so carefully at that, but Peter Siegel is starting to look at the stroma that's in metastatic lesions. But of course, you have to be able to harvest the matched metastatic lesion to the primary tumor, and that's not so easy to do. We can get liver metastasis with from Peter Matrakas, and Peter's been looking, the other Peter Siegel's been looking at that.
So that was beautiful. It certainly agrees with a lot of the other epithelial cancers, with prostate and ovarian cancer, where there's a big stromal influence on tumor biology. But my question is, in your mouse model with P10, so you're starting with the different genotype where you have the mutation in the fibroblast cells, and then you're adding in the epithelial tumor, which is a different genotype. And so what happens in the endogenous tumorigenesis situation? Are those stromal cells coming from the genetic events that are occurring in the epithelia, and you're getting a mesenchymal epithelial transition? So I just want you to put that into perspective.
Right. So what I think we have to be careful to say is that there's no good evidence to say that there are mutations in stromal cells. So just to get that clear, this is only a tool to look at how changes in stroma would influence the tumor evolution. What we believe is that the changes that happen within the tumor reflect the ability to recruit and different stromal cell types into the tumor microenvironment, but then also to sustain them, to promote proliferation, survival of these cells. For example, in this very hypoxic environment, these are normal cells that are growing in an extreme stress environment. So they clearly adapt. You can look at the, and what's very interesting, if you look at metabolic coupling, and people have just started to look at this, we know that tumors have highly glycolytic metabolism due to the Warburg effect. But what's known now is that the stroma that's recruited into the tumor bed also sustains this metabolic coupling between fibroblasts and the tumor cells. So again, depending on the dependencies of the tumor, you may expand or recruit specific cell types into the stromal bed.
In your mouse models, is there a differential sensitivity to drug therapy?
Yeah, that's important. We haven't gone in and done that. That was part of the plan that we had, but we didn't get that far. But what's very interesting, and we're just starting to look at this in mouse models, we can now see subtypes of human stroma that could be described as fibrotic stroma, so lots of collagen deposition. Then if you look at, say, immune cells, or for example, CD8, CD4 positive T cells, these patients that have this very fibrotic stroma have a very low number of CD8 positive T cells in the tumor bed, even though you can have a lot of T cells in the stromal bed. So they somehow get stuck, or it doesn't sustain their ability to get into the tumor bed. And so this becomes a really interesting question, because if you could then change the phenotype of that stroma, the patient seems to be eliciting or recruiting T cells into the vicinity, but they don't get into the tumor. So this, you know, these are questions. And when you go back and you look at immunohistochemistry, a lot of labs will count T cell presence, but they usually don't discriminate between the stroma and the tumor bed. And it's actually quite difficult to do that pathologically, and there are now algorithms that allow you to do that, you know, in a statistical manner, and I think that's important.
So actually, along the same line, what I was wondering was, you had this nice correlation with immune reaction and better survival, and I was wondering if you see a specific type of immune signature that would predict survival, because you did have a range in some.
Yeah, so we can see that quite clearly, and Mike Hallett has gone on to do very big studies to look at that, but there's clearly distinctions between M1-like macrophages and M2-like macrophages, which are split with good survival with the M1 presence, poor survival with the M2 presence. We've now started to drill into distinct subsets of immune cells that we can begin to identify distinct subsets, and so we can now go in with a lot of immunohistochemistry-type approaches to look at that and validate that, which is clearly a critical thing within the tumor sections. And the importance of this is that we can go back into the FFP sections that are held in pathology and make direct comparisons with those tumors compared to the frozen sections that we're working with in the lab. And this is a huge advantage for us. Yeah.
Let's thank Mara once more.